Guess what, cinephiles? I have just heard something absolutely mind-blowing. Okay, so you know when you search for something on Netflix, what you get is only a tiny fraction of what Netflix actually has. Netflix actually has more than 18,000 titles globally, but only like 6,000 of those are available in the US. So you're missing out on literally thousands of great shows, unless you use ExpressVPN.
Yeah, Steve, ExpressVPN is an app that lets you change your online location. So like, for example, if you're looking for stuff that's from another country, you're based here in the United States, you can actually change your online location to Australia or the UK so you can control where you want Netflix to think you're located. They have over 100 different locations. They're on ExpressVPN. So you can gain access to like thousands of new shows no matter where you live. And this works with many other streaming services too. There, you guys have Disney Plus or Hulu or Max or the BBC iPlayer, which is the one I use. I know I've used ExpressVPN to connect to Australia because I really love this show called Have You Been Paying Attention? I just put myself in Melbourne and I get access to it. You sign up using your email, but you immediately get access to the stuff. I've used the BBC iPlayer to watch a number of shows there on the BBC, like Law & Order UK and others. And sometimes this show Guilty that I love that screens there, when the new seasons pop up, because it takes like 4 months to get them on PBS, I watch them there using ExpressVPN. And it's incredible how easy it is and how simple it is to use.
So why should you use ExpressVPN? Well, first of all, it is super fast. That means you can stream everything in HD with no buffering. It works on any device. So I'm an Apple guy, which means I've already installed it on my Mac, on my iPhone, on my iPad, and on my Apple TV. I'd install it on my Apple Watch if I could, and it encrypts your data. Now, this is hugely important because it protects your privacy and your security to keep you safe from hackers. So stop missing out on great TV and get thousands of new shows with ExpressVPN. We got them to give you guys 3 extra months of free use when you use our special link, expressvpn.com/cinephiles. That's expressvpn.com/cinephiles to get 3 extra months completely free.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hi, this is Steve. With everything going on in the world right now, it seemed like a good idea to find a movie that could make us all feel good. A movie that would bring us right back to our childhood and give us that warm, fuzzy feeling that's, well, it's in far too short supply these days. The truth is, I can't think of a warmer, fuzzier film than the original Muppet movie. I was 10 years old when it came out, and I can still remember seeing it on the big screen with my whole family. No matter what else was going on, the Muppets were something all of us could agree on. And if that's not enough to convince you, we'll be joined by actor and puppeteer Michael Ostrom. Michael worked with the Henson Company for 11 years, and he will give us a rare inside look at what working with the Muppets is really like. So please join Kermit, Fozzie, Piggy, Gonzo, Rolf, and the rest of the Muppets as they go on a quest to make millions of people happy. So that's the Muppet movie coming this Friday to the Cinephiles. Trust me. You won't regret it.
You've got talent, kid. Singing, telling jokes. I mean, if you get your tongue fixed, who knows? You can make millions of people happy.
Millions of people happy.
Millions!
Hello and welcome once again to The Cinephiles, where each week we enter the world of a great film. We explore its themes, its history, the filmmaking, and the influence it has on us today. My name is Steve Morris. I'm a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
Hello, everyone. I'm John Rocha. I'm a voiceover artist, podcast host, show host, and actor here in Los Angeles. I like to throw it all in there.
Sure.
Why not? You got to survive in the city. It's what I'm trying to tell you.
Does anyone survive in the city?
You got to survive. Yes. We're doing the podcast. We're surviving. We're paying our rent.
I suppose. You're right. And we realize, as you know, we're trying to explore every different genre of film we can.
Yeah.
And one that we haven't gotten to yet, which I'm really excited that we're finally here, is a family film.
Yeah.
And we're going to do the very first Muppet movie.
The Muppet Movie.
The Muppet Movie.
I love that.
Yeah, 1978, directed by James Frawley. And as we were talking about doing this, I went, wait a minute. I have the perfect person to talk to. my old friend Michael Ostrom is an actor and puppeteer who ended up working for the Henson Company. Michael, welcome to the Cinephiles.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me, guys. I was very happy to be here and to share whatever I can about my life with the Muppets.
So I'm really curious is, how did you end up, how does one become a puppeteer?
Well, it's very interesting. When I moved to Los Angeles a long time ago, in the 20th century, a good friend of mine, Vinny DeRamis, he was working at Jim Henson's Creature Shop. And after a year of me kicking around L.A., I finally needed to get a real job.
Sure.
And he helped me get a job answering the phones at the Creature Shop around the year 2000 or so. And long story short, 11 years later, I left the Jim Henson Company as the production manager of Jim Henson's Creature Shop and a puppeteer. Mm. How that happens, it's interesting. When I first started working there, they said, hey, man, if you want to be a puppeteer, this is not the way to do it. Don't get a job here and become a puppeteer. Those people come from the outside, and they don't work their way up. And then somehow I worked my way up and became a puppeteer.
So I want to start just with the Creature Shop. What's the Creature Shop?
Jim Henson's Creature Shop is... Well, when Jim Henson started, his first puppet shop was in his basement, then his garage, and then he got pretty successful pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. Started a New York puppet workshop called The Workshop, and that's where they built the puppets for Sesame Street and all the Muppets. But then as his life took him overseas, the Muppet Show got its funding to be produced in England. He created a puppet shop there. And then as he went into creating the creatures for The Dark Crystal, he knew he wanted to go in a different direction from a regular puppet shop, and he wanted to create something that was use different disciplines like sculptors, electromechanical engineers. And along the way, he wanted to differentiate between puppets and what these things were. So he called them creatures. He didn't want to call them just animatronics. But and the way Brian Henson describes it, his son, is that a puppet, if you were to cut a puppet open, foam would come out.
Right.
If you were to cut a creature open, you should expect blood and guts to come out. It is a thing that is to fool you into thinking this thing is alive. So that's the difference between a Muppet puppet workshop and the Creature Shop. So the Creature Shop then went along for years and years in London doing all kinds of films for other clients, not just the Henson Company. And then after Jim passed away, the project Dinosaurs for ABC Television came up. So they needed to create a similar workshop in Los Angeles. Mm. And that's how the Los Angeles Creature Shop got its start. It was at Rowley Studios in the basement of a soundstage building the dinosaurs for the dinosaur show.
And what did you, as the manager, what was your title? You were the...
I was the production manager.
So at the production manager of the Creature Shop, what did that mean you were doing?
Well, I did all the not fun stuff, you know. there's a wonderful room full of puppet builders, and I managed the business side of that. That I literally managed payroll, supply, scheduling.
It is all the not fun stuff.
All the not some, all the Muppet spreadsheets and things like that.
But all the necessary stuff so that everybody could do what they could do to build the puppets and also have them used in the numerous productions that they were going to do them, put them in.
So, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So without this, without the production manager, nothing gets done.
Right. And I learned that I needed to become a liaison between clients and the builders in terms of like what we wanted to build and then look at the budget and then look at what the puppet, you really try to build a puppet to do exactly what it has to do. And if people start arguing about the money, you start to try to scale back without sacrificing quality. And I learned a lot about business in this business.
I'm sure.
Things I never expected to learn.
Well, it's funny. One of the things, there's a great biography of Jim Henson, which I read about a year ago.
Yeah.
And one of the things I learned through that, I think from watching Sesame Street and the Muppets is I think of those guys as performers because I have such a relationship to the characters they create. And I didn't think about until reading the book about them as builders.
Yeah.
You know, is that building the puppet is such a huge part of creating that character.
Yeah. Well, that book is the biography by Brian J. Jones, which I can't recommend more highly. Having just finished it recently myself, it made me put together the pieces from my time at the Henson Company. I understand how this company came together and why it runs the way it runs and the commitment to creativity. But speaking to builders and performers, there's always this cross-pollination. I'm not a puppet builder. I come to this as an actor.
Right.
I know how they're built because I hired the builders for a while. But there are plenty of people like Dave Goles, who plays Gonzo. Mm-hmm. He came into Jim's life as a builder. He was a design person. And eventually Jim kind of convinced him to try and to puppeteer and to do these different things. And lo and behold, then he becomes Gonzo the Great. You know?
Right.
So a lot of puppeteers I know here in town are builders. And that's great because they know how the puppet works inside out. A lot of times as a performer who doesn't build puppets, you may get a puppet given to you on set and realize this wasn't built to fit my hand. This puppet doesn't really work well with my hand. I have to fight against all this stuff to get this puppet to look good. So People come from all different types of disciplines. Sure. A lot of great puppeteers never set out to be puppeteers at all. Mm. And some puppeteers, some of the people that are Muppeteering today, were like literally teenagers outside the Muppet Studios on the phone going, "I'm outside, can I come in 1978? And now they're still working for the Muppets today. Wow. Like, wow. Some were hungry go-getters and some were like, "What? Puppets? I'll try it. Oh, now I've been doing this for 30 years.
Right. You know? Well, let's go back and we'll get a little bit of history because Jim Henson's life is so interesting.
It really is.
Is that he starts professionally doing puppets in high school,
mm-hmm.
and is on local TV, mm-hmm. and starts to develop some of the characters, including, I think, the character that eventually became Kermit, mm-hmm. had been around for... since the 50s.
Steve, yeah. Can I ask, where is this in high school? Is he in L.A. or in California? So,
he's in outside Washington, D.C. Okay. He's in Maryland.
Oh, wow. That's
Maryland.
My own town. Yeah. Okay, wow.
He went to the University of Maryland.
Really?
Yeah.
He's a Terrapin. Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah. Okay. And so it's like from 54 to 61, fresh out of high school, and then while at the University of Maryland, he's doing local TV and starting to develop some of the characters. And then he ended up on a national show, which is, I just drew a blank on the guy's name.
Okay.
Where he created Rolf the Dog.
Oh, the Jimmy Dean Show.
Jimmy Dean Show.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
So the Jimmy Dean Show, and there's a lot of scenes where Jimmy Dean is talking to Rolf the Dog, and suddenly this character, that's the first one to really take off nationally.
Right.
And at the same time, they start doing these coffee commercials,
mm-hmm.
for, do you remember, what's the name of the
coffee? Wilkins Coffee.
Wilkins Coffee, which, by the way, go on YouTube and check out these commercials.
Oh, my goodness.
Because you see the early Muppets, and they are pretty sick for the
time.
Yeah.
If you know, there's this thing, there's this constant battle about, like, the Muppets, they're for kids. And then people say, no, they're for adults. They're for everybody. Jim was very... very much interested in the puppets being for adults, and they really did start for adults. These coffee commercials were on during like the Hunt Brinkley News Hour at 11:15 every night, and the Sam and Friends, this TV show rather,
Sam and Friends was
a show they almost always, the Wilkins and Wilkins coffee commercials, the basic premise is always Wilkins says, "Hey man, do you drink Wilkins coffee?" "No, I don't." And then Wilkins murders Wilkins.
Yeah.
Every time. Kills him with a cannon, cuts him in two with a guillotine. They're incredibly violent.
It's itchy and scratchy all over again.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Very much so.
Yeah. And it creates this thing where it's like, which we know from Bugs Bunny and from cartoons, is like, if it's not real, we can do all these horrible, horrible, violent things.
Right. Yeah, that puppets can say and do anything.
Yeah.
Back then.
Yeah.
It seems like we're more sensitive now. I wonder if we could ever have a Tom and Jerry cartoon now. You know, it doesn't seem to be. So back then we had a little more sensibility. We understood it was a dip, but now everybody's kind of. It seems like everybody's a little more hypersensitive and it might not fly in the same way.
No, we're in this. We talked about this before. We're in this weird world of political correctness and being, which I think is, you know, much more sensitive to what is the impact of the things that we are saying and doing. And at the same time, we don't get to say and do some of the stuff that we used to do back in the day. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about is that I think there's something they talked about in the early days where the way they use video monitors to help. How does that work?
Well, we still do it the same way they used to do it. The monitors have gotten a little more lightweight and flexible, but everything you're doing is... you're looking at a monitor. It's television puppetry. It's not the same as just like doing a puppet show in public in a library. Like if I were to do that, I'd be lost because I work with a television monitor. What that is, you're seeing the image straight from the camera. The trick is the image has not been reversed. So if you move your puppet, to your left, it's going to come on screen to the right. Everything is flipped.
Even still today?
Mm-hmm. We prefer it that way.
Why?
We're trained to do it that
way. Just because you're used to it.
Because
it wouldn't be hard with today's technology to have a flop.
It would be hard for us to work with that. We ask people not to flip the image for us.
Right.
It's just not the way we've been trained.
Yeah.
And there's all kinds of things that go into not just sticking the puppet up in the frame, but then how that puppet relates to the frame. How the puppet, like one of the tricks as a puppeteer is to make sure when your puppet walks into a frame that you are creating a floor for the puppet's quote-unquote legs and keeping that consistent. Also keeping the puppet's eyeline and focus consistent. It's a lot of people think like, I'll just do the puppet myself. I'll just shoot a puppet thing. And then you see the difference between a trained puppeteer and an untrained puppeteer.
Yeah. That's fat. So let me start with this. Where are you? So there's the set and you're sort of below the set.
Well, it's all different types of situations. If we had our druthers, we would build the sets about 4 feet off the ground. And when the Muppets are shooting their own thing, that's usually the way it is. But if the Muppets are guesting on like Good Morning America or someone else's house, then that puppeteer is crammed and jammed underneath the available wherever they can be.
Right.
Yeah. Sometimes you'll ask for a little masking or something to hide the puppeteer or the puppeteer assistant. Often the puppets are being performed by two people. So, you know, like when we just
Why would you need to have a puppet controlled by two people?
Oh, well, that's always been the way. Live hand puppets like Fozzie Bear, that's when the one puppeteer is doing the head and one hand. And you'll notice both hands are moving and articulating. That's a puppeteer assistant is doing the other hand.
Yeah.
And those two performers need to work in concert together. And that takes years. People have trained on Sesame Street for years being right hand assists before they become characters of their own. And you can do that with rodded puppets, too. Sometimes if you have another puppeteer do both rods while you just do the head, then suddenly all kinds of neat and amazing things can happen.
I think that was
We also mess with each other sometimes. If you let someone else do both rods, suddenly they're kind of screwing with you. It's like that improv game of put your arms behind your back and someone else does their hands. Yeah.
That was one of the interesting things I discovered doing research for the show and looking at the Muppet movie, like how much of that was used when they were shooting the film. You know, like the opening of Jim Henson, or the opening of Kermit singing Rainbow Connection, Henson is in an underwater like containment system talking to people walkie-talkie, but someone else is maneuvering the arms while he's maneuvering the body.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have Frank Oz possibly in the full Fozzie Bear outfit dancing on the stage, all these kinds of things that they did because we'd never seen their feet until the movie. Kermit on the bike is jarring too. It's just jarring.
Well, I remember seeing that done too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a one thing I've understood about Jim is like whenever a new project would come out, he was always eager to try something new.
Yeah.
And I think that shot you're talking about when Fozzie's in the El Sleazo and you see him full body,
dancing,
which is kind of jarring as a kid because we've never seen it before. Like, oh, that's what he looks like from the waist down.
Yeah.
Hey, one thing I want to mention in terms of like technique, if you don't mind me throwing this in there, is having recently read the Brian J. Jones book, I've always known that Jim invented a type of puppetry where he took what like Kukla, Friend, and Ollie were doing or Howdy Doody were doing, which is basically point a camera at a puppet show as it was understood.
Right.
What Jim understood was with the camera and the lens, I can make the television screen my puppet theater. And the Sam and Friends puppet, the Sam, was actually a very a plastic puppet. His from the mouth up, nothing moved on him.
Right.
And he was paper mache. He was a rigid head. Kermit was like the next big puppet he built.
Mm-hmm.
And he built him specifically so that basically you're seeing Jim's hand with fabric wrapped around it with two ping pong balls on. So he's using his fingers. And that was not just because to make the puppet more malleable, it was to make it more malleable on camera because he knew I'm going to do close-ups with this puppet and I can get all kinds of expression out of this puppet. So that just making one of the Kermit is almost the simplest Muppet there is. He really is like a glorified sock puppet.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He's always with Jim. It was about how can I get the most out of this potential of television and camera and stuff. You look at classic Sesame Street bits like Near and Far.
Yeah.
Right.
I often demonstrate this when I give tours at the Henson Company. Like to make a near and far thing happen, you'd be surprised how little the puppeteer actually has to move because of the focal length, because of the lens. You think the puppeteers are running all over the soundstage when actually you can just take a step back and hold the puppet a little farther back boom, suddenly it's tiny. And then with a step forward, this puppet looks like King Kong. He's freaking huge in the lens. It's very interesting how it was morally, even more than puppets, Jim was fascinated with television and the potential of television and what it could do.
Well, and the thing you said about him always wanting to try something new, like that's Walt Disney. That's that's Pixar. Like these companies that were continually trying to innovate.
Mm-hmm.
And that I've heard this from Pixar, and I know it's true of Walt Disney too, is that the technology drives the art and the art drives the technology.
Mm-hmm.
So that you have writers and people with ideas saying, hey, I want to do this, I want to do this, I want to do this. And then the technicians have to figure out, well, how are we going to do that?
Right.
And then the opposite happens too, where it's like, hey, we have this ability to do this. Mm-hmm. And that gives the artist new ideas. It sounds like that's exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
With Hanson Company.
Yeah. He would come up with what he wanted to do and then have the magical, it really was magical workshop, figure out how to get it done.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the best special features when you watch animated films, because those take like 3 or 4 years, right? And you see, it's like they take time to get the technology right, to get it to fit, you know, get hair right, get water right.
Mm-hmm.
And the great ones are always driven to improve, to do better, to push the boundaries, to whatever. And so it's no surprise that Henson had that within him, you know.
Yeah,
and
clearly.
The thing you mentioned about Kermit is so great because it's ironic. Easiest Muppet, yet the most emotive Muppet that they have. Like his feelings through just the hand movements and the pushback and everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how you are just immediately gravitate to that character because he seems like an underdog always, even though he's, you know, in charge of them. He always seems like an underdog waiting to fail.
Well, and that's
what's so great about it. When did he switch over from doing the adult version of the Muppets to more of a kid version that brought about the Muppet movie?
Well, it's Sesame Street. I mean, that's the big... So he was always resisting. He didn't want to be just a kid's thing. That was something he wanted. He thought this could be entertainment for everyone, and then makes the deal with Sesame Street. He becomes a huge, important creator within Sesame Street on a lot of... Because he directed some of the animated things. And one of the interesting things, by the way, when he makes the deal for Sesame Street, he maintains the rights to all the characters that he creates.
Wow, smart.
Yeah.
So Kermit and Ernie and Bert and all those are his.
Right.
So, yeah, so Sesame Street is huge. And then this idea, he does the Saturday Night Live thing, which, man, I've watched those. They're terrible.
Well, a couple things, as you probably know from the book, Henson and Oz, they didn't write the material for the Land of Gorch, I think it's called.
Yeah,
on the Saturday Night Live writers. And it was a the Saturday Night Live writers didn't care for it. That's where the phrase "the mucking Fuppets" comes from.
Right,
that's a John Belushi quote.
Michael O'Donohue said, "I don't write for felt."
Right, and he hung a Big Bird in the offices. But if you read that book, you'll see that Lorne Michaels and Jim Henson regarded each other very highly, and they parted ways very amicably. And from my personal experience, the Muppets themselves were on Saturday Night Live years ago when Robert De Niro hosted.
Right,
and I remember I spent Christmas Day going back over to the Henson offices because FedEx had. Not lost the Muppets, but they. Christmas is a busy time for FedEx.
Sure.
And they hadn't showed up by the time we left work on the 23rd. So I had nothing to do Christmas Day. So I went over and there they were. And I just counted the Muppets and made sure they were all okay.
Wow. Kermit brings us out of Sesame Street because he's like a reporter in Sesame Street.
Yes, I remember that. He's great in that.
Into getting to the Muppet Show,
yeah.
Which is, and which I didn't realize, which is they tried to sell the Muppet Show over and over again mm-hmm. in all sorts of different versions, including there's a fantastic, I definitely recommend going on YouTube. And finding the pitch for the Muppet Show where there's a reporter basically calling out the names of the big executives. I think it's ABC.
Maybe.
And saying, you're going to make so much money and the Muppets will make money and Jim Henson will make money. Have you ever seen this, John?
No.
Yeah, you got to check that out.
It is one of the great pitches. And it didn't work. They didn't sell it with that.
Like, no, just there's other stuff out there. Like when I worked for the company, I went to New York and we did a pitch for ad agencies. And then I found there's already this movie Jim had made in like it's black and white film where he's making a pitch. I think it's to McCann Erickson. And it's very similar. It's like, work with the Muppets. It's going to be great. Here's how we work. And then it cuts to Jim and Frank Oz, and they're all really young, and they've got go-go girls on set, and they're drinking beers and eating sandwiches. Like, then we take a little break, and it's the funniest thing.
Yeah.
He was parodying television while he became a master of television.
Well, and this is, I mean, in a weird way, they remind me of Monty Python in this level of we're operating on all these different levels at the same time. We are doing the thing, and we're doing it really well, and we're making fun of the thing that we're doing really well, and we're sitting back observing the thing that we're doing really well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so finally we get to the Muppet Show, which, did you watch Muppet Show as a kid?
Oh my God. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 I had a Pigs in Space poster in my bedroom. You know, in terms of my life with the Muppets, at one point, the classic Muppet puppets came to Los Angeles and were kind of, I was literally given the key to the room they were kept in. And I was the guy that they would say, we need this puppet for this show. I'll get it for you and I'll sign it out and I'll keep track of it.
Wow.
And I kind of got used to it fairly quickly, but every once in a while I'd go, wait a minute, Dr. Strangepork is in that room. Hang on a second. And I would go get my little key and I'd go in there and I'd take out Dr. And I remember specifically Dr. Strangepork. I took the puppet out and realized this is not just Dr. Strangepork. This is the Dr. Strangepork.
That you grew up with.
The puppets have tags in them that tell you when they were built, who built them, what shop they were built. And I'm like, according to the math, this is the one. Wow. And I still never get over that.
That's
awesome.
Yeah. Even on set with the Muppets, sometimes I'll look in the mirror and be like, look at what I'm doing.
Yeah. Because you could meet Adam West today and go, this is the guy that was Batman.
Yeah.
But he doesn't look the way he looked in 1966. Yeah.
Right.
And you honestly can't stick your hand up him
and
make him come alive in the same way.
Yeah, the Muppets are evergreen.
Yeah.
John, you know, hold on a second real quick. I want to circle back.
Sorry, you had a little trouble with that.
I've never had a visual of shoving my hand up Adam West's
ass. Oh, my God.
But all right, there we go.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
John, do you watch The Muppet Show growing up?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, those are the things you know, my parents, they're from Bolivia. You know, they're immigrants to this country. So to them, their real big thing was for me to watch television all the time. So I wouldn't speak English with an accent. Like, they had this paranoia about it. And I was first born. So for me, sitting in front of the television every night was basically my night. Every night until like 9 or 10. So
I've never been so
everything.
Jealous of you.
And seriously, I would watch like Mork and Mindy, Two Girls. Like, I watched everything growing up.
Yeah.
And the Muppet Show was something that all of us could watch as a family, right? And enjoy. And my parents got the jokes every once in a while because they obviously knew the famous actors or actresses or celebrities that they would have on the show. But the meta jokes, when you go back and watch the show now, the meta jokes are what makes the show as an adult. You go back and watch it. These are still great to watch, fun to watch, and they're just happy shows, right? Yeah. I mean, near the end, you could see they were falling apart, but for the most part at the beginning, it was so fantastic, so much fun. And it's why the Muppet movie is so good too, because it's just an extension of the show.
Sure.
And broadening out the where they could go and how far they could go. And also the film itself is meta within meta. It's a film about a film,
right,
which is fantastic. And right. So I mean, the Hare Krishna jokes alone just sell it for me. Sell it for me because of the time frame.
My wife grew up army brat. She grew up on bases all over Germany and stuff like that. And so when she was a little kid, they would have the Muppet Show in German on television.
Oh, right.
And I remember she says her and her brother were like, we'll just try to read their lips.
So
greatest puppeteer in the world can have great lip sync, but you're still not going to be able to read those lips.
So for me, my memory of the Muppets was it was one of the three or four shows that we watched as a family every week. It was on Sunday.
Yeah.
And that we all liked it equally. You know, it wasn't like you were watching a kid's show where the kids are being forced to watch a grown-up show. The other ones were Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom.
Oh, yeah.
Julia Child.
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
Those, Child. And the Muppets. And maybe like Hee Haw or something, too. Yeah.
Sure.
Might have been in that list.
That's but 70s it was like, syndicated television.
Yeah. Right and yeah. I feel like it was on 6:30 or something like that on Sundays. All right, let's get into this movie now.
Yeah, the movie. Yeah.
This is an origin story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is the
kind of the Blues Brothers.
It's the Blues Brothers. We're, yeah, the same thought. We're putting the band together.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And we're going to go off in this venture, which starts with Kermit in the Swamp singing Rainbow Connection.
Why are there so many songs about rainbows? And what's on the other side? Rainbows are visions, but only illusions. And rainbows have nothing to hide.
And we got to talk a little bit about Paul Williams.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Paul Williams is the songwriter for the Muppet movie. He is among the most successful songwriters of all time.
Yeah.
And there's this era in the
70s. Also an ape. Don't forget he's an ape.
Yeah. He's in Planet of the Apes.
An orangutan.
He's in weird TV shows. He shows up on The Love Boat. He's
He was in that Kiss movie. What was it?
Is he really?
Yeah, he's in Phantom of the whatever.
Phantom of the Paradise.
Phantom of the Paradise. Yeah. He's in that or one of those Kiss movies. I know that.
Yeah.
And he writes some of the greatest songs of all time.
He and Jim worked on an episode of The Muppet Show. And that collaboration was, that's how we got involved with the movie.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Jim loved working with him so much.
And Rainbow Connection's a great, great song. Mm-hmm. And then we have Dom DeLuise, the first of our many, many guest stars. And this is this kind of movie
that
we don't make very much, which is that we're going to have every guest star we could possibly have show up. And he tells Kermit, hey, you should go to Hollywood and be rich and famous.
Yeah, just rich and famous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and it's funny. Here's a thing that I was thinking about a lot, which is that he says rich and famous. And there's two ideas that happen right at the beginning, which is rich and famous and make millions of people happy.
Right.
Yeah.
And I thought a lot about the difference between those things, because it isn't the desire to be rich and famous that is driving Kermit the Frog.
Mm-hmm. No, no.
He wants to make millions of people happy.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think about today and society and why people are becoming actors and why people want, but it's like people are seeking rich and famous. Often maybe we're not seeking to make millions of people happy as much as we could.
No.
You know?
Well, because our society is more about, it's changed so much since 78 to now about self-satisfaction. Like exploring what makes you happy, what makes you, and if you do what makes you happy, then the money will follow, then the fame will follow, then all of that will follow if you make yourself happy. Whereas in before, it was more about sacrificing for the common good. I think that has changed a lot in our approach. Now, yes, this, it's still topical. This movie still works today, this idea of rich and famous versus making millions of people happy. And it's a great thing, point you bring up, Steve, because that's the journey, right?
Well,
and he accrues people who are in his mindset about making millions of people.
And what I know, which I'm sure you guys know too, being in Hollywood and watching this happen, rich and famous does not make people happy.
No.
The people that I know that have become rich and famous, they ain't happy.
No.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, now that I'm a little older and I've had some friends get rich and famous and stuff, and I think, wow, they had a great run. And now it feels like you spend 20, 30 years after that, people going, what happened to you?
Yeah.
Like, what do you mean, what happened to me? I worked my ass off. I got rich and famous. I did what I loved. And society moved on, but don't make fun.
It's rough.
They can cry themselves asleep in their mansions, but still.
At least I had a shot at it.
Exactly.
At least I was rich and famous. What are you still doing?
Well, that's a good point, too. And I want to get to something you brought up earlier, which is it's the shot of Kermit on the bike.
Yeah.
That's the shot I remember as a kid. And I didn't know that I hadn't seen Kermit's legs. You know what I mean? Because
yeah.
you're a kid.
Yeah.
But then you saw it and you're like, what is that? How are they doing that?
Yeah. I remember that moment in the theater as a kid. Like, being like, oh my, how? And then it's just so great. You stop wondering how and you just accept it. And then the next film, they did one where they're all riding bikes and stuff like that. I mean, I could tell you how that's done, but I don't want to ruin the magic.
I don't know. What's your vote, John? Do we ruin the magic?
Sure. People want to turn it down for the next couple of minutes, they can.
It's not that complicated, yet it is very, very ingenious. Back in the day, there were just certain moments when they realized that you just can't get a puppeteer in a certain situation. You just can't fit them to get that shot you want. And the technology they used to achieve that, they still used on one of the more recent Muppet movies I worked on. Oh, wow. There was a shot that was cut out of the 2011 film where it wasn't cut out. The character of Walter is whistling on stage by himself. Mm. And you can see his legs standing there. It was done exactly the same way. And that's what we call an RC Muppet, a radio-controlled Muppet. It's quite simple. I don't want to credit the wrong person for it. I think it was Faz Fazakis. I think it's how you say his name. He was one of the original tinkerers. It's a condescending term. He was an electromechanical engineer. He was a gadget guy who would figure this stuff out for them. And it's a very simple thing. Radio frequencies send a signal from a mitt that's called a Waldo mitt.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can listen to me as I flap my hand in the air so you can see what I'm doing. But it basically in real time translates through radio frequency the puppeteer's hand moving, flapping the mouth into a puppet that is filled with radio controlled servos and is receiving that radio signal and reacting in real time. Back in that day, of course, it probably had to be quite close to it. Radio frequencies have gotten better. Yeah. Sometimes when we're on set, we have to make sure the walkies aren't interfering with an RC puppet who's working on set. So that's how that was done. And then it's not just the mouth, obviously. It's the head and neck movement, left, right, up, down. So there are corresponding servos that translate that. And then that solution led to when it came time to do The Dark Crystal and Labyrinth, he wanted that turned into an animatronic control system, which also sometimes had cables attached to it, but then moved away from that. And that now has led to a computer animation control system. The Henson Company still uses it on shows like Sid the Science Kid, a show coming out right now called Splash and Bubbles. They're using, the puppeteers are still controlling. I've used this system. It's called the Henson Digital Performance System. And it's basically an animatronic rig used to control digitally animated characters, which can cut down on animation production time. But also, from a creative point of view, gets back to a performer controlling a very complicated puppet.
Right.
Like, a lot of the Henson people helped work on Yoda, for example, even though that's not a Henson production, a Henson thing. But they were all friends and they all knew each other. And the original Yoda was a team of like four or five puppeteers controlling like one eye or the other eye. So these people had to rehearse for weeks and weeks just to get to a common language of expression. And Jim appreciated that, but also realized we're moving away from one performer.
From one individual.
So all of this technology is basically trying to get back to a sock puppet like Kermit, where a performer like myself could possibly study how to use these systems and then throw it all away and get back to performance.
Oh, wow.
That's such an interesting thing that I always think about technology is like you have a pencil and a pencil works really well and it's old, simple technology. You have a piece of paper, you do anything you want and you can have a thick line or a thin line or, you know, you could stop and start and erase. And then to get to a pencil on an iPad, you have to have billions of dollars of research and huge advancement of technology to get to this thing that we had, you know, 100 years ago. And it seems really similar with this, is that the natural and, you know, barrierless connection between the artist and the puppet of a hand and a sock and a piece of fabric, to get back to that, you have to do this massive amount of technology.
Right. But what you're getting, though, is something much more... We're back to the difference between a puppet and a creature.
Right.
To get a creature to look like a creature and have all those different things that we accept as a living thing is a complicated process with an animatronic creature or very realistic animated character. So if you can have a control interface that gets it back to something that sophisticated being controlled as simply as a pencil or a sock puppet, that's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. So we go off. So Kermit decides he wants to make millions of people happy, and we go off on our journey. And who is the first member of the team we find?
Fozzie Bear.
I love.
That's my favorite.
Paul
Muppet,
Williams
is
there playing the piano.
Don't shoot the piano player. That's right.
Showtime.
In the horrible, filled with villains kind of bar.
Yeah.
So James Coburn.
Yeah,
and we got James
who's
Coburn.
The owner?
Why don't you complain to the owner? I am the owner. Plus, the movie is filled with so many of those wonderful little punny jokes.
Yes,
little one-liners, crazy great one-liners. Jerry Jewell wrote the film; it's so great.
Well, and again, those one-liners come into this when you're a kid. They're just funny.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
And then when you're an adult, you're laughing at the dumbness of the...
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. here comes another one.
Well, yeah. They build a giant fork to stick in the road.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Damn it. You're not going to believe this.
So John, Fozzie, yes. Fozzie's your favorite?
Absolutely. Listen, I know who I am. I am a Fozzie Bear. Absolutely. I want to be on stage. I want to be liked for what I'm doing. But I don't always get there, and that's just how it is. But my heart's always good, and I want what I go after. And so for me, I've always felt like Fozzie Bear. I've felt a kinship with Fozzie because he always seems somewhat out of step, but he's doing the good fight. He's fighting the good fight, mm-hmm. and he's naive at times when he should be a little more aware of what's going on. Yeah. So I love that about him.
I think they take him right up to the edge of being sad.
Yeah.
Beautiful,
yes.
But they never cross it. Mm-hmm. Like there are things. I mean, it's not that he's not aware that he's bombing.
Right.
He is aware, but he doesn't, and it does get him down.
Right.
But it doesn't get him down to the point where he is so horribly depressed.
He doesn't quit.
And if at the end of the bit he can squeeze one last joke out, he's back to being happy.
Yeah.
You know, he's not knocked down by Statler and Waldorf. Right. They're there giving him hell all the time. But he keeps coming out.
In the bar fight, he slides out and becomes the bartender with the beard, sends everybody up to the top, and he escapes. So he's still smart enough to get out of the situations. He's a veteran of the circuit in a way.
And it goes to, in a way, these are these messages of the movie, but it's the resiliency of the artist.
Yes.
It's not that the artist doesn't fail. It's that you actually are going to fail over and over and over again.
Right.
One thing I miss is like a lot of these animated films, I don't go to see a lot of them, but it seems like it got sort of lazy. Like these animated films are like, and now here's a Smash Mouth song.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But this has all original music.
Oh, right? Yeah. You Which know? Gets us to our next song. We're off with Fozzie on our road trip, and we get to Moving Right Along.
A frog and a bear seeing America. Moving right along in search of good times and good news. With good friends you can't lose. This could become a habit. Opportunity knocks once. Let's reach out and grab it.
Yeah!
Together we'll nab it.
We'll hitchhike bus or yellow cabbit.
Cabbit?
Moving right along.
Which I, as a kid, my sister and I left just singing that song for about a week after we left the theater, you know? That album must have been a huge hit.
Oh, yeah, I had that album. Yeah.
I think I had it, too.
My dad bought that for me, if I remember correctly.
I actually don't know what my favorite song in the movie is because each one I hear, I go, that's my favorite. So we've moved right along.
Yes, we have.
And
by the way, that is my favorite song.
Moving right along.
It's number one.
I love it. Might be. But I don't know.
Yeah. Other movie songs,
but then we get to the Electric Mayhem.
Yeah.
We get to this church, which probably isn't my favorite song, but it is a great musical number, and we find this hippie, crazy band, you know, living in the middle of the nowhere, who I love. They want to put up a cafe with live music in a church, and it's like, man, where have I heard that recently?
Yeah.
It seems to be still going on.
Yeah.
And we get to this thing that happens throughout, like, the movie where they say, they have to pull out the script and reread the script to figure out what has been going on.
Yeah.
So great.
Which is this thing that happens throughout of we're in a movie talking about a movie, referencing the movie we're in. The levels of reality are, which as a kid, I think, I don't know if they went by me or I just loved them. I don't know.
It's meta beyond meta beyond meta. Like, it's just so deep, deep. It's like that scene where Wells is walking past the mirror and you see the mirror and mirror, 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 mirror all the way down. That's what it's like. It's going so deep in it. And the fact that they use it later to save them is hilarious.
And a little subtle thing I love about that moment when Teeth brings out the script again, he's been doodling all over it.
Yeah, that's right.
He's covered in all these doodles and stuff. It's all curled up, and he's been carrying it the whole time.
That's right.
And
as you do with a script.
Yeah, sure.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
Hello, Cinephiles fans. You know, we all kind of walk around with these stressors, big, small, medium, in our lives that are triggered sometimes by frustrations at work or frustrations at our job or just frustrations overall about our life. Because sometimes, you know this, if you compare, you despair, and you just want to live a life that's a little bit more clean and accepting of yourself and a little more open to receiving positive messages for yourself so you can have that life that you want to live and have that great work-life balance. And it's not always easy.
And for me, for years and years, I thought all of this stress, all of this hardship, I had to just carry on my own, that this is what it meant to be a man. And it was finally getting therapy where I realized, like, oh, I don't have to carry that stuff. There's a place where I can unburden myself and actually get advice and guidance about how to deal with it better in the future.
Yeah, Steve, you and I have spoken very proudly about how therapy has helped both of us deal with our stressors in our lives. And if any of you are listening to us who are thinking of starting therapy, well, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and it's suited to your schedule. All you have to do is to fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge if things aren't working out, which I think is a great benefit.
So get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/cinephiles today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/CINEFILES.
And I think at this point we realize, like, because you've been watching the TV show, because everyone who went to see this movie was a fan of the TV show, like, oh, we're going to meet all our people.
Yeah.
You know, and how exciting that is. I think next we meet Gonzo mm-hmm. at the fair, mm-hmm. Who has a great introduction and his strange obsession with chickens.
With the chickens, yeah.
His wife, yeah. This is definitely something that goes to an adult sense of humor.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you always have to be going like, what is Gonzo doing with these chickens?
Just don't go too far.
Yeah. But it's out there.
We all have our fetishes. There's nothing wrong with it. That's just how it works.
Yeah. And then one thing I quickly learned working at the workshop was like someone came to me and said, we need Camilla.
Oh, yeah.
For a bit. And I went, oh, okay. And I get a chicken. Said, that's not Camilla. I'm like, oh, how do you tell the difference? And I wish I could remember exactly the color, but these chickens have eyelids.
Yeah.
And Camilla's eyelids are a different color than the other chickens.
Oh, wow.
She's purple or blue or something. But Camilla is a specific chicken puppet. She looks exactly like the other chicken puppets.
You're right.
Other than these.
Yeah, but for whatever you do, that stuff becomes serious.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, if you're good at, especially, it's like, no, it is this one.
Right.
Well, let's get to Miss Piggy.
Yeah.
So my son, Jackson, we watched it for the second time. Halfway through the movie, he goes, I don't like Miss Piggy. Yeah.
Oh.
And I said, what do you mean by that? What do you mean you don't like her? I said, do you mean that you don't think she's funny and you don't like her in the movie? He said, no, she's funny, but she's a bad person.
Yeah.
Miss Piggy is an amazingly complicated.
Yes.
Well, she gets that call from her agent and
leaves him.
Bye.
I mean, what the? I've just sacrificed. I've fought for you. And boom.
Yeah.
Well, she is I don't want to say a false person. She is laying out a character that is not real. Throughout the whole film, and there are layers of what her reality is, mm-hmm. yeah. because she's like, lovey, lovey, lovey. All right, give me the information, right. You know, on the phone.
Right.
You know, she is, and it's like, oh, I think that's the real her.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I would take a little bit of exception with, I would say that she is who she is always. Mm-hmm. So you either take it or leave her. Like, Kermit sees the other side of her and knows that she plays this one thing because she's incredibly insecure, wants to be loved, mm-hmm. but there's another part of her. It's like Sally Field in Soap Dish. It's basically that, right? She shows herself to be this America's sweetheart, but underneath, she's this very ambitious, driven woman to be the number one person on whatever she's on. And a lot of actors have that. A lot of actors.
And she's happy to use whatever tactics are necessary. Yes.
Well, could you say she's in it for the rich and famous and Kermit's
of course.
People happy.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
and she will guilt Kermit. Mm-hmm. She will pressure Kermit.
Right.
She will manipulate him into giving her the love that she wants.
Yeah.
And Kermit knows it's happening. And you could see, like, when she shows up back, when she goes away mm-hmm. and then comes back, and she gets into the car with all the other people, there is this serious Yoko Ono moment going on. When they're just like, oh, no, here she is again.
Right, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting line to walk, you know, because it could come off as chauvinistic, it could come off as misogynistic. But I think because she is how she is and still powerful in her character, mm-hmm. it doesn't cross that line. I think that even now it doesn't cross that line. When I watch it, I watched every episode of that Muppets show that was on ABC when they tried to reboot it again. Same character, same thing. Pushed the boundaries, still stayed within her character, which I think is a positive thing about this mm-hmm. whole all the Muppets in this movie.
Well, and it's this thing that the Muppets do so well of walking this line of, we're going to go, like Fozzie goes right to the edge of being depressing, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. but doesn't quite get there. Piggy goes right to the edge of being, you have to reject her
because
she's so horrible, but she's still so amusing that she just keeps you, mm-hmm. you keep wanting her back in.
And I've witnessed, I can't cite anything in particular for various reasons, but I have witnessed the Muppet performers work with a script and change lines to keep that consistent.
Oh yeah.
Sometimes, like, there was a bit, I can't remember what it was, on the new TV show where Fozzie responded to a character and they just said, that's just too mean. And they were right. He wouldn't say that. And the writers were like, oh, of course.
Right.
And because, so the performers playing them now are caretaking that very carefully.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, and Pinky does save them, right? With the machine, she saves Kermit when Kermit's about to get brainwashed. So she's not opportunist all the way. She does really care about it.
She loves Kermit
in her way.
There is no question. She loves herself maybe more.
Yes, of course.
But I just want to take a minute to remind everybody we're talking about puppets.
Right.
But that's the genius of Henson and the puppeteers to create such characters that we gravitate to and know and love.
Well, what I've heard, and I'm sure you've experienced this, is that particularly with the kids, but with anyone was interacting with one of these puppets, they would talk to the puppet.
So do directors and boom mic operators.
Really?
Boom mic operators will lower the mic above the puppet. Even though you're under the table with the lav mic on a headband, perfectly sounded up. Like, could you get a little, brother? Can you? You can just put that away, my friend. Yeah, it happens all the time. Yeah. Also, you'll be under the table and under the set, and they'll say, like, can you have him look over here? No, over here. It's like, I cannot see what you mean by over here. Tell me on the screen what part of the screen you want me to the puppet to look at, my friend. You know, it's always a learning curve on puppet shoots. And I will say, I worked on every episode of the ABC show.
Oh, cool.
And Randall Einhorn from The Office, he directed almost every episode, was an executive producer. He brought a crew with him, a camera crew. And my God, they were like puppeteers as well. Pretty quickly after filming the pilot presentation, this crew got... It was very hard to do puppets handheld like that show did.
Yeah.
And they got what we needed for every setup. Because we can't just be like, we're going to pan over and find your puppet. Well, by the time you pan over, my puppet might not look right anymore. So they would show us the number two look before they'd swing back and do the number one. It was like such a finely oiled machine. It was such a joy to work on.
Yeah.
But that's later in history.
So one thing we haven't gotten to is there are bad guys in this...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Charles Durning.
And then Max, Austin Pendleton as Max. He's like such a suffering villain.
Works all the time.
Yeah.
And whenever
he
shows up in anything, I'm always like, I immediately get a smile on my face because I've seen him in so many things. And he's always great with that voice of his. I don't know.
He starts with that green vinyl cap. It's like he's clearly on Kermit's side from the top of the show.
That's a good point.
Because when Kermit's about to get crushed, he's the one screaming, no, jump out of the way, jump out of the way.
It was almost gone with the Schwinn.
That's right.
And Charles Durning plays a great classic.
So good. I saw him play Big Daddy in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
Oh, wow. Awesome.
Basically the same characterization. But still masterful.
And they are chasing Kermit down to get to make him the spokesperson for their frog leg fast food.
And how great those legs that he sees look like the McDonald's arch.
Oh, yeah.
He's so smart.
And it's funny because this is our first sort of family movie. Family movies have to do this a lot of dealing with actual death.
Yeah.
You know, because what they're talking about is a company that takes creatures like Kermit and deep fries them so people can eat them.
Isn't there a crutches joke in there somewhere? So
there
it kind of softens it. Like the old National Lampoon record cover. That's not funny, that's sick, I think it was. The person to the restaurant, frog leg special. There's a frog reeling out of the kitchen on one of the little carts.
That's right. That's right.
So he's chasing down Kermit to be his great spokesperson.
Right, spokesfrog.
And it escalates. First they're trying to bribe him, then they're trying
to get a little meta, by the way, Kermit started as a spokesfrog. Or puppets like him started. Jim is Kanye parroting himself, too. He's going to get into advertising. He needs Kermit to do that. Commercials were a huge part of the Henson Company. That's how they got started.
Yeah, and they continued to make money through it for a long, long time.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt.
So we're battling each of them while we have all of these guest stars popping up in every single scene. I made a list of them here. Let me find it.
Oh, yeah. I can tell you Telly Savalas, Madeline Kahn, Carolyn.
Yeah. Watching again, I was like, Telly Savalas is hardly in it.
Yes, for like a second.
But as a kid, I was like, hey, Kojak's here.
So we've got Dom DeLuise, Madeline Kahn, Telly Savalas, Carol Kane, Milton Berle, Elliot Gould, Edgar Bergen, and Charlie McCarthy. That's a great one. Bob Hope, Richard Pryor, Steve Martin, Mel Brooks, Orson Welles is at the end of the movie. Cloris Leachman. Yeah. I mean, there's so many, and I probably missed some.
Yeah, well, and the film is legend for Bergen and McCarthy's last appearance on screen doing anything. So it's just great callback to that, you know, and that's respect for what came before, entertainment that came before, right? Henson has an understanding of history and a respect for it that works multi-generational. And it's, like you said, Steve, a family film, it's multi-generational for those reasons.
One thing I learned from, again, I'll recommend the Brian J. Jones biography, is that Bert Lingstrom, oh boy, the puppet community is going to murder me, the guy behind Kukla, Friend, and Ollie, he helped Jim and Jane find their first New York apartment. I mean, they were friendly with these people. Yeah. Jim was very involved in the international and the national puppetry community. He maybe didn't start out to be a puppeteer, but he very quickly understood, I need to respect this art form.
Right.
And he learned everything he could about it and became a puppet master.
Well, this is the thing I learned reading that book was I didn't know there was a puppet community.
Oh yeah. My god!
You know?
Oh yes, there is.
What's the guy downtown? Bob
Baker Marionette.
Bob Baker that they knew each other and that all these people knew each other and there was competition and there was a lot of pride and learning lessons from each other.
He met Frank Oz at a puppetry convention. Frank's parents were puppeteers. And Frank himself wasn't so sure he wanted to be a puppeteer, but he grew up around puppets, so it was very easy for him to become one. Right. And look what Frank did. He directed some Henson films, then went on to be a director and left the puppets behind for the most part.
Yeah.
One of the most unsettling stories with Oz was the Brando story on the score. Like Brando was such a jerk off to him, and he said, "I'm not going to take direction from Miss Piggy." Like at one point, and he had people relaying directions from Oz through an intermediary to him. That's the kind of hubris that drives me nuts about certain people. Oz is so great and so fantastic at what he's done. Yeah. Even in that Blues Brothers cameo when he's like being the prison guy signing out stuff to give to Belushi.
I love this.
So great.
There is a DNA between the Blues Brothers and the Muppets too. Absolutely. Same time period. One certainly more for adults. I saw both of them as kids and loved them both.
Me too.
But I forgot Frank was, and Steven Spielberg. At the very end. Help you guys with something?
He's eating the sandwich.
He's eating the lunch. Sandwich. a lovely Easter egg in the 2011 Jason Segel Muppet film that I was there when we shot this bit was Madman Mooney's Used Cars.
It shows up again.
Right. Not only does it show up again, the 2011 film found the original used car dealership in Van Nuys, and we shot there for a morning.
Wow.
And they said they found Milton Berle's costume. And there's a gentleman who plays if you look closely in the 2000, it said Madman Mooney and Sons Used Cars. Nice. And there's a fellow who is not a spring chicken who's wearing the suit. And very quickly, you see the same thing happens again. Sweetums goes, he runs away, and then he comes back, wait for me! And we went so far, the film went so far as to try to completely recreate the same tracking shot, because Studebaker leaves and takes a right and goes down this street and goes off in the distance. And then Sweetums comes and runs, and they get there, they see that in the years since, they put up this iron gate around the used car dealership.
So
they couldn't get the crane to do that shot. They did it as a cut.
So then Kermit and Miss Piggy go on a date.
Mm-hmm. Suddenly he has a tuxedo.
We have this very romantic scene, and we have Steve Martin essentially doing the bad waiter thing.
Who was on top of the world right
then.
Let's Get Small was huge. I mean, people cheered when he showed up.
Oh, waiter?
Yes? May I help you?
The wine, please.
Oh, you mad impetuous think it's champagne.
Not exactly. Sparkling Muscatel, one of the finest wines of Idaho.
Well, you may serve us now, please.
Oh, may I?
Look how he does that.
Yeah. Very suave.
Don't you want to smell the bottle cap?
Smells good.
Yes.
Just love that scene.
Yeah. Oh, may I?
Oh, may I?
Yeah. And, you know, people have said that, you know, that Steve Martin, the excuse me bit, was kind of like the ultimate me generation selfishness thing.
Right.
And now you've got him doing that persona in the face of these innocent Muppets.
Yeah.
And it kind of softens his edge because we're on their side, even though he's going to do his I'm a jerk shtick.
Right.
But
they're just too naive to get what a jerk he's been, which is a lovely way to handle it.
Right, because they think the best of people, therefore they wouldn't.
Right. They don't get into this guy wearing the shorts.
part of it is we know we're watching a movie.
Yeah.
You know, like you're just like, oh, here's Steve Martin. Even as a kid, I knew who that was, Steve Martin.
Yeah.
You know, because I'd seen him probably on The Muppet Show and other things. And it's like, oh, this is a sketch.
Yeah.
We're having fun with the fact that this thing is here.
Yeah.
And then we get this great scene with Kermit and Rolf.
Oh.
A scene where Jim is talking to Jim. Isn't it?
Evening. Rolf the dog. Sit yourself down.
Kermit the farm.
Pleased to meet you. I'm no Heifetz, but I get by.
That was very nice.
Oh, hey, broken heart, right?
Was it sure?
Listen, when you've been tickling the ivories as long as I have, you've seen a broken heart for every drop of rain, a shattered dream for every fallen star.
Exactly.
Gosh.
And I think Rolf's my favorite character.
Yeah, amazing. I can see that.
He's got some wisdom.
He does.
He's been around.
He's kind of accepted the resignation of his life. Like, he's where he's at, and he's just like, I'm doing it, and I'm a piano player, and that's the way it is. But he's got great wisdom for Kermit of, like, you know, can't, well, women, what are we going to do? You know, that kind of thing.
Well, and I get the sense from Rolf that he's happy to play in this horrible restaurant.
That's what I'm saying.
And he probably would be just the same if he was playing at a big concert or if he was playing on TV, and he's just going to be Rolf. Mm-hmm. Nothing's gonna faze him.
It's amazing how many depressives are in the Muppets. Right? Gonzo, Fozzie, Rolf, you know, they all have their... But they want something more. They gravitate to the energy, the brightness that is Kermit, the hope that is Kermit. Then that's what he accrues. Well,
it is the best version of artists coming together that I can think of, where it's like we're all crazy, we're all sad, we're all motivated by all these things, and we all love and support each other's craziness and sadness and dreams, and happy for their dreams to be whatever their dreams are. It's not that anyone says to Gonzo, what you're doing makes no sense at all, and you'll probably die.
Yeah.
They're going, you have to be Gonzo.
Yeah.
You know?
Is that whole the show must go on thing?
Yeah.
Like, when I, you know, I was trained as an actor, and then I had to finally get, like, a day job. And I remember sort of thinking, like, oh, man, I'm an actor. What do I know about the real world of work? And I'm a flake and all this stuff. And then, like, a publishing company I worked in San Francisco, they ended up offering me, like, this full-time job. And then my wife kind of reminded me at the time, she's like, well, that's because as actors, the show must go on. And we get it done.
Yeah.
Opening night's going to happen whether you're ready or not. So be ready for it. So we're very good project-based people.
That's
we're
true.
Very strong, well, yeah, project-oriented.
I mean, all three of us grew up as theater people.
Yeah.
And, like, that's the thing I learned, is that you had to get this done.
Yeah.
And you had to be organized. And you had to show up. And you had to paint the set. And you had to do and learn the lines and do all the things, because the show is an absolute.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
show must go on, as you say.
Yeah. And there's nothing greater than the joy, especially when you're first starting out, like in middle school or something, of that abject terror and fear and stage fright. And then when it's over, you did it.
Yeah, yeah. The adrenaline rush.
We did it. Now I want to do it again.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. yeah.
Like you, I managed a facility for 3 years with DVD testing. I had a crew of 20 people.
Oh my goodness.
We had to get projects done for all the major studios. And it was that. It's that they understood. Whatever needs to get done, get done. Whatever we need to move around, we need to move around.
Right.
Because you're right. Because that determination to finish.
Yeah.
It does not go away. And so we delude ourselves as artists that, like, oh, we couldn't handle a regular day job. But if it's the right job about completing projects, troubleshooting situations, that's what we're born to. That's what we've been doing our entire lives.
We
how am I going to pay rent? What do I got to grab now to make sure I can pay rent?
Oh, you know? I can hustle.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That's the goal.
And the idea that I think you hear all the time, like, oh, artists are flakes.
Yeah.
Okay, yes, sometimes it's true.
Sure.
And sometimes all of us have been flakes in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Maybe unrealistic, or maybe, you know, all those things. But artists are also people that get stuff done.
Yes.
Because if you're not working in a corporate structure, if you're not working with deadlines and a support staff, and it's like, if you're going to get something done, like this podcast.
Yeah.
This podcast happens because we choose to do it.
Yep.
And we do what is necessary every week to put the show out.
Yep.
And there is no safety net for us.
I left the comfort of a woman's bed to be here this morning
to talk about
the Muppet movie. I mean, the comfort of a woman's bed to
be here.
Does
your wife know this?
You can't live with them. You can't live without them. There's something irresistible-ish about them. We grin and nerd because the nights are long. I hope that something better comes along.
I see what you mean. It's no good complaining and pointless to holler. If she's a beauty, she'll get under your collar. She made a monkey out of old King Kong.
I hope that something better comes along.
Kermit coming to sing with Rolf, and that is Jim singing with Jim and talking to Jim. How do we do that?
Well, it's very simple. Even in the early days of Sam and Friends, those commercials, Jim had a little tape recorder. And before he and his wife, Jane, would go film a bit, he would record both voices and get the rhythm right. And then he would rehearse to a playback. So in a lot of those Sam and Friends shows and Wilkins and Wilkins, that's how they did it. So that's how you do it. You have one puppeteer performing one of Jim's characters while Jim does the other one. Mm-hmm. And often for the hero shot, the master puppeteer, Jim in this case, would take Kermit back and do the voice. And then another puppeteer would keep what we call keep Rolf alive. Right. And you don't just, like, I've done this. I won't really say which characters I've played because I don't want anyone to think I'm taking any credit for these characters, but I've kind of had my hand in most of the major Muppets at some point. And the job of that puppeteer is to keep that puppet alive in character. Mm. And what's great is the master puppeteer, the regular performer's right there saying, you know, Ralph would maybe tilt his head a little here, or he would look this way, he would nod, or when you nod, don't know. Very subtle things, but you're caretaking the character for the other performer right there. Like that's what additional Muppet performers like me do. We play the other character while the main puppeteer is playing the speaking character in the shot.
So if we have two, so in that scene, if we have two people played by the same character, is the audio always pre-recorded?
I think in the case of the film, if they're in conversation in one shot, I would say they're playing. They might be performing to playback.
Mm. And if you had Jim Henson and Frank Oz, would they be doing it live?
Yeah, probably.
So the only one,
because a big thing for Jim was improvisation as well. Apparently in the Sesame Street days, they could barely get through takes, and they really didn't stick to the script completely because Jim and Frank had such a chemistry that they improvised a lot. And that's to kind of go all over the map. The show I'm involved in right now, Puppet Up, comes from Brian Henson having witnessed this as a child, that the funniest stuff happened when they would yell cut, and then Kermit and Fozzie and Piggy would go very blue, nothing that you could show to the children or the families of the world. But he said that, and then Brian developed Puppet Up as a way to train basically the West Coast, well, all of his current generation of puppeteers to kind of get that looseness. So we brought in Patrick Bristow from the Groundlings to give improv workshops to puppeteers with a camera. And someone
said, you were an improv guy. I mean, I knew you back in the day.
I really started here in L.A. at the Groundlings. I mean, I did some improv, but I studied it at the Groundlings when I got here. And basically those workshops, someone said, the best thing is to do this in front of an audience. Let's get an audience together. And of course, Brian doesn't know anything halfway. He got a bunch of bleachers. He got some cameras. We used the soundstage over at the Henson Studios. Right. Happened to invite some people from the Aspen Comedy Festival.
Sure.
Next thing you know, you've got a show. And that has been a show that's been around for almost 9 or 10 years now.
Wow.
But that goes back to the soul of what Jim and Frank were doing, which was goofing around with these puppets in front of cameras.
Well, and I was thinking about it before coming here. I think Jim Henson and Frank Oz are one of the great duos of all time, and totally unique, because normally if you have Abbott and Costello, or you have, you know, John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd, or whoever you want to name, a comedy duo, they're only playing two parts. Mm-hmm. Whereas that Jim and Frank are a romantic comedy couple.
Yeah.
They're best friends with Fozzie and Kermit.
Yeah.
You know, they like play all these different characters together and yet maintain this.
Bert and Ernie.
Bert and Ernie, but maintain this fantastic chemistry.
Oh, and the trust, they loved each other. When it came time to make Dark Crystal, they co-directed that film.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, Jim trusted Frank implicitly, you know. Yeah. And it's interesting, you talk about Kermit still, does he want to be rich and famous? Does he want to make millions of people happy? Well, as his journey begins, he also wants to make the weirdos and nuts that he assembles around him. He wants their happiness,
too.
Yes, absolutely.
And
the key.
He quickly becomes the caretaker of their happiness for really the rest of Kermit's career as a character.
Still now, even through the ABC show,
still
doing
trying
the same
to take
thing,
care
yeah.
Of well, his friends.
And, yeah.
In impossible circumstances with people that aren't always that grateful to him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and he continues to just choose, I have to take care of these people. I have to do the right thing over and over again. So, and then we get to this moment in the desert of this great existential crisis for Kermit. It's just an amazing moment of the seriousness of what we're talking about, which is, and you do have to have, you know, it's always darkest before the dawn. You do have to go through this moment and that Kermit has now officially taken on the role of I'm responsible for these people.
Right.
And how do you get to that? Like, no one asked him to be responsible.
Right.
Well, again, read that biography, and I think that's sort of where Jim Henson was.
Yeah.
His company grew very quickly, and, you know, he didn't necessarily set out to run a big company, but he wanted the autonomy. But then he always felt this responsibility for all these people he'd gathered together, and he wanted to keep them together. Right. You know, it was very hard to run a creature shop when there's no job coming in, but eventually he did do that. He put people on payroll for years and then kept scrambling for work, even though he was the great Jim Henson.
Right. Yeah.
He still was very dedicated to the people he employed. He's Kermit.
Yeah. Oh, very much so, yeah.
Yeah, because Kermit's going to look out for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No matter what.
Yeah, we all could use a Kermit in our lives, I think, sometime.
And he has that Henry V moment where he's like,
oh, yeah.
I've brought these people this far, and now I've failed them. We're not going to get there. And he has to see himself. He has to have a conversation with himself, which is very similar to what Henry V has right before the Battle of Agincourt, what Christ has in the garden when he's like, can this cup pass over me? There's all these shades of it when he has that. Even Star Wars, where Luke is facing himself in the mask, in the Vader mask, which is, of course, an allusion to the possibility that Anakin is his dad, or Darth Vader is his dad. So all of that is there. It was so weird to put that in a Muppet movie. You're like, yeah. What is this doing here? But it's an adult moment, and kids are smart enough to get those moments because kids at that age still have their own conversation with themselves. Like, they're starting to develop conversations with themselves. It's just brilliant on so many levels, the film.
Well, and this is why this is a family film and not a kid's film.
Yeah.
Like,
Yeah, it's not exactly. It literally is for everybody.
And for you to enjoy it at the place that you are. And I was thinking about this with, I went to see the new Pete's Dragon, which I actually liked quite a bit.
Great reviews. Nobody went.
I really liked it. I don't understand. Well, and what's weird is that's a family movie.
Yeah.
That's the kind of movie that doesn't, like The Black Stallion or like, you know, where that, I was like, oh, this movie doesn't exist that much anymore. Mm. Other than some of the Pixar films.
Yeah.
That when you go to see an animated kid film, it's jokey and loud and stupid and fast. And like, that's what it is. And I'm not saying that's bad, but this idea of what the Muppet movie is really unique and something that I miss.
Yeah.
Before we move on, I want to talk about something. Like, one thing I noticed, that you mentioned how like the adult stuff versus kid stuff for Jim Henson. And while it is true that Jim always longed for them to be remembered as that we do adult comedy as well, primetime comedy, stuff like that, when he did work in children's television and throughout the rest of his career, whenever they did something in children's television, it's very interesting that Jim didn't want to just put on a kiddie show.
Yeah,
like when Muppet Babies became so popular from the sequence in the whichever Muppet movie, the Muppet movie, and then they said, hey, we could do an animated Saturday morning show. Jim initially resisted Saturday morning, and then he realized, wait a minute, the kids are there anyway, so let's do something commercial Saturday morning. But he made sure that it wasn't just the Muppet Babies being the Muppet Babies. That whole show was about imagination. There was a mandate on that show. So even though he dabbled in both sides of things, when he worked for kids, he was all in for the kids. You know, that warm, fuzzy feeling of the Jim Henson vibe is not just, that's the real thing. That's real Jim, you know?
Well, there's a clear moral core to the Muppets. And a clear sort of, this is what we believe in, a belief system.
Right.
That with all the silliness is always there. And I think that's one of the things that I think people don't get when they examine. So finally we get to the big showdown at the Old West Town, which for some reason, Dr. Bunsen Honeydew and
Muppet Labs,
Beaker,
just
Muppet Labs
right
is
when
in
you need
Old
them.
West Town.
And growth pills.
Which I think Beaker is my wife's favorite Muppet.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So we have this final showdown. And what do you have is Kermit making this decision essentially to sacrifice himself to save everybody else.
Yeah.
And it's fairly heavy.
Yeah,
it is, because he has there's nothing in the story to suggest that he has a plan.
No,
he's just going to face it.
He's just going to face it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But all the entertainment we like as kids has that heavy theme. Lord of the Rings has that kind of heavy. You're reading Lord of the Rings at 10, 11 years old, right? Yeah. 12 years old. You're reading all these things. You're discovering heaviness in your entertainment, in your media, because you probably dealt with it as a kid or you know someone who's dealt with it as a kid. It happens. And so it's about coding it in all this other stuff that makes it palatable when you're a child. And that the death is heavy, or the prospect of his death is heavy, but it's played for jokes from the beginning with the wheelchair and the crutch and everything. Like, it's all played for jokes. So you know he's going to sacrifice. He might be, but it's about the nobility of the sacrifice, not necessarily the result of the
sacrifice.
It's
that great moment when all hope is lost.
Yeah.
And then the hero takes that extra step.
Yep.
And then we get rescued by Animal.
Yeah.
A giant animal.
And having read, again, I keep saying this, the book, I read that, you know, Frank says Jim didn't want to do anything small. He said, like, keep it simple, then let's make a giant animal head. And I got to say, looking back at it, I was like, I'm trying to say, how big was that head? How much of that really was it? I think they did make a giant animal head.
Oh, wow. Like they did.
Yeah.
But they also did some kind of a matting. They must have. I don't know. I have to look at it again.
Yeah. It's really cool.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
And I remember that happened. I was like, yeah. You know, as a kid, you're like,
great, great heroic moment. All right, I think it's time to get the standard Rich and Famous contract.
Oh my gosh, I'm a huge Orson Welles fan, and I was as a child then.
All three of us are.
How poetic and glorious is it that Jim Henson made him the head of a studio?
Lou Lord.
Yeah.
Named after Lou Grade.
That's right.
The benefactor.
With Cloris Leachman as his secretary, who is, I think, we talked about her in Young Frankenstein, one of the great underrated people of all time.
Yeah. Oh,
She is so good in every single thing she has ever done.
And a little wardrobe hair touch. I love that she's got this 40s, crazy 40s updo. Like, she is from the golden age of Hollywood. She's been working for this guy. You know, she still has like Art Deco, lovely office and everything.
But
and
once again, this is because this film is told through Kermit's point of view. Mm-hmm. And we get that when we're sitting in, right, the movie starts. Kermit walks up to take a seat, and his nephew says, like, yeah. Uncle Kermit, is this how the Muppets started? He goes, approximately, yeah. Because right. It's all through his eyes. In his eyes, he sees the grandiose of Hollywood. And all. So naturally, she'd have a 40s hairdo and all that kind of. And he'd be sitting behind this huge desk, and he spins around.
Yeah.
Well, in that moment,
a button on his desk.
That's right.
Well, in that moment is... that moment is show business.
Yeah.
Is this really what happened? Approximately.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's that nobody in this... I mean, obviously it's not true because Kermit never lived in a swamp. Kermit's made of felt. But
Jim grew up near one.
Okay.
There we go.
But it's also... This is a construction within a construction within a construction. Like all theater, all movies, it's all lies.
Yeah.
But it's wonderfully told lies that have the jewel of truth within them.
Yeah.
You know? So, and then we get Orson Welles and there's this long pause... Where they say, we're here for the thing. We're here for fame. And then a long pause, and you got to love Orson. Yeah. And then he says,
Miss Tracy, prepare the standard rich and famous contract for Kermit the Frog and Company.
Yeah. Which is exactly what would never happen. It has certainly never happened to any of us.
And nor to Orson. That's for sure.
Nor to Orson. but I cannot tell you how many times I've mentioned the standard rich and famous contract.
Sure.
I want that standard Richard Pace. Who doesn't? You know? And then they go off to make their movie.
Yeah.
And the movie is the movie of the movie that we just watched.
The two-dimensional set pieces and that whole number floating by.
Yeah. And then we're like, oh, cool. We're going to make the movie of the movie. And and this is sort of a cliche now, you know, that like you have the artist trying to tell the story. And at the end of the story is the story of the artist trying to tell the story.
Right.
That's a cliche throughout a lot of movies. And so we're comfortable in this space and what's going to happen. And then this remarkable thing happens, I think.
Yeah.
Which is that it breaks.
It fails. Yeah.
And then they turn to camera and start with another great song.
Life's like a movie, write your own ending. Keep believing, keep pretending. We've done just what we set out to do. Thanks to the lovers, the dreamers, and you.
Cry.
Yeah.
And I don't know why it makes me cry.
Because you're an artist. You understand. The failing at the last possible minute when you have everything squared away is the greatest fear of every artist.
Yeah.
And it's like the dream is gone. Oh, no. I was so close. There's that always that is ingrained in us since we were probably kids, you know?
Well, I think it's the reaction to that moment is that they're not hurt by it.
Yeah.
They go, this is what we're doing.
Yeah.
Keep believing.
Well, the hero takes the next step.
Right. Yeah. Right. You keep going forward.
And I love what you just mentioned. Like, he looks at us.
Yeah.
And as a little kid in the audience, I mean, how many people? I might have been inspired by this myself to get into the business, you know?
No, I'm teary-eyed right now.
I'm still waiting for the rich and famous contract.
We all are. But that moment of them, here's your mission now. Right. Yeah. Keep believing, keep pretending.
Yeah,
it's very reminiscent of what happens in Meaning of Life when he comes out of the refrigerator and sings like, let's say Eric Idle sings that song.
Yeah.
I always correlate those two songs because when she's like, they're taking his guts out or her husband's guts out and he's still alive and all this, she's all depressed about the world and he comes out and he sings the song, you know, and it's so great.
What's so funny is like you've taken us from this moment, and I think you're totally right.
I am right. But
now we're taking it, going to live kidney donations, and life's a piece of shit when you look at it. And you know what? They're both right. They're actually very
similar. Yeah, because it's
about
perspective. It's when you're spinning, and you're like the small speck in it, but because everything, because it's not that big of a deal. You could still do it. You could still live. You could still survive. Like them singing with hanging on the crucifix.
That's the crucifix.
Yeah,
I quoted the wrong song.
Yeah.
That's a really dark place. But really, so is the life of an artist.
Sure.
It's a fairly dark place where you continue to choose that dreams and imagination are important on some fundamental level. And this brings me something I want to say about the movie, which is that this is a movie about old school entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, is that you used to have this idea, which was the original Muppet Show, of the variety show of we're going to have song and dance and jokes and fun. And that's what we're here for.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie, that's the dream they're following. It's not that you're going to see Streetcar Named Desire starring Kermit the Frog.
Right.
Like, that's not, they're talking about, we want to entertain you, and entertainment as a value.
Mm-hmm.
that this is a good. It doesn't have to be about deep stuff. It doesn't have to be. It's like, if we entertain you and make you smile for an hour and a half, we have done good in the world. Mm-hmm. And I think that is true.
Well, I think that's what the symbolism of the rainbow coming in.
Oh, yeah.
For the real rainbow coming in, right?
After the artifice falls apart.
Exactly. Yeah, the real reality of it is. Yeah, yeah. That's the beauty of it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a remarkable moment. Okay. So, John.
Yes.
What are your final thoughts on the Muppet movie?
Please, if you haven't seen this in a long time, go put it on. The way the world, what has happened with the world in the last few weeks and people's reactions and the kind of sadness and depression and also the anger and the gloating and all this has been happening in our society, in our country, and in the world, really. It's always nice to go back and revisit the things that inspired you and made you happy and made you smile. And the fact that just because we're different doesn't mean we're not equal, doesn't mean we don't have value. And I think it's always good to go back and see that, because even in the film, not everyone believes as Kermit believes, but they're still all together. And that's what matters, right? And that's what's so important. I think that film, these kinds of films should never leave our consciousness, because they're so important for us to go back and touch and feel again and be inspired by again and be happy again and believe again. And that's what I loved about going back, especially with what's happening now. It was so fun to revisit it and be joyful again and inspired and happy and, you know, all those kinds of things.
Absolutely. Michael, what do you think?
You know, being kind of a Muppet insider and having recently finished Brian's
and
book,
having been inside a Muppet.
And having been inside a few Muppets. yes. I back up everything you just said. But also, I see it just currently as like, I watched it in relation to where Jim was in his career. Mm. And here was a fella who, through hard work, he loved work. That's a big takeaway from the book, was he didn't understand why people griped about working. No, maybe because they hated their job, but he worked so hard. And this is just, the Muppet movie is still just the beginning in a way, even though they had the series on and it was an international hit. Just that steady progression. But through it all, he didn't even think about compromising the integrity of the message of what he wanted the Muppets to be, which is not just kiddie stuff. People say, oh, these be more adult in terms of being naughty and blowing things up. But it's more than that. They didn't just blow things up and make funny jokes. He made sure there was a moral core to the Muppets. And it's all in this first film. And I think the stuff following up with it has been sort of like trying to figure out how to maintain that while also satisfying the market and being competitive. But when the Muppets are at their best, they're staying true to that original intention.
Mm. Yeah. I was thinking a lot about this, is that all art starts with some kind of an emotion. Mm-hmm. You know, you're angry about something, you're sad about something, you're filled with longing for something or wish something or miss something. And this movie starts with love. Mm-hmm. You know, it starts with love in a fundamental way, love of art, of music, and love of these people that, as you said, John, all these characters are really different. Mm-hmm. They have different goals. They come from different places. And yet they all share the same love of this elusive idea of making millions of people happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's all. And so to be taken on that journey with them, there's such a joy to it. Mm-hmm. And for me now, being able to watch it with my kid and have these same characters that I loved when I was not much older than him are now, you know, characters that are alive for him. And to remember that, you know, a lot of times it's just a hand in some cloth that all that emotion is coming through. And of course, it's the love of the artist that created it, of Frank Oz and Jim Henson and all these other people and technicians trying to create this one thing. It's really a remarkable movie.
And the joy of friendship.
Yeah.
It's the joy of friendship.
Even when those friends irritate you and piss you off.
Yes, of course.
One thing it's sort of telling too is I think some people in the puppet community, rightly so, the puppets are valuable and expensive to create, and they're very precious. But I've heard more than one story about, like, when Jim was done with a shot, kind of tossing Kermit to the side.
Right.
And that sounds cruel or indifferent. That's not what it was. These puppets were a tool for him.
Yeah.
Right.
These were equipment.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds cold, but no, Kermit was a means to a bigger end for Jim, and it's all in this movie.
Naturally.
Yeah.
All right. So that's it for this week. I hope you go back and watch some Muppets, explore some of the other work of Jim Henson. If you're interested in that biography, it's fantastic. Michael, thank you so much for coming. Where could they reach you if people want to get in touch with you?
Well, I got this website, my name, michaelostrom.com. I'll spell my crazy Dutch name for
you.
It's MichaelOostrom. You can check out my podcast with my friend Vinny, who got me started at the Henson Company. Our podcast is called Nerd Like Me, and we hope to be creating some more of those for you guys soon. And as of this recording, I'm waiting to hear where I worked for the other great children's television company of the 60s and 70s, the Crofts. on Sigmund and the Sea Monsters, the reboot, and we're just waiting to hear if we get a series order for that. But I hope we do, because that's another children's playground.
Can people help with that? Can they go on?
Then go to Amazon, watch it, and write how much you love it.
Yeah, that'll help a lot. Yeah,
and I think you really enjoy it. There's some really great cameos in that, too.
That's another huge part of my childhood is all those Crofts.
Oh, another episode. And also there's Puppet Up. We just finished a run in Las Vegas at the Sands Showroom at the Venetian, and we're figuring out where we're going to go next. So keep an eye out for that. You can go to puppetup.com and look for notices. Very well could be coming to a city near you. We travel the country. We travel the world with that show. And that's Puppet Improv for adults, not for children.
Yeah.
Live on stage. There's a camera, two big monitors. You can choose to watch the puppets being naughty, right, taking your suggestions. Or you can watch us underneath the puppets and see how we do this, how we puppeteer these puppets.
Right.
That's awesome.
So, John, where can they reach you?
You can always find me at The Rocha Says, R-O-C-H-A, on Twitter and on Instagram. I always like to respond to you guys, so please reach out to me. It's always fun to have interactions. You guys see the shows. You can see the shows I'm hosting, co-hosting, and get to be a guest on. I host The Walking Dead recap show, review show over at Collider on Sunday nights. And obviously this show, and then also Super Animation Game Time with Yuri Lowenthal, 1 p.m. every Wednesday, Pacific Standard Time, on the Geek and Sundry Twitch channel.
All right, and as always, you can reach me at SR Morris on Twitter. And that's it for this week. We will see you next time on The Cinephiles.